So we could welcome Brent to present a government view.
Thank you. Good afternoon. As well as talking a bit about the government activity, which you might deduce from it being 10 minutes long isn't much. That's not quite true. I'll also talk about a bit about the why, is why we are interested in IPv6. There's a thing called the e-government vision and an e-government strategy within the public service, and it says that by 2010, which is only next year, the operation of government will be transformed as government agencies and their partners use technology to provide user-centred information and services and achieve joint outcomes. Then it goes further and says by 2020, people's engagement with government will have been transformed as increasing and innovative use is made of opportunities offered by network technologies. Each of those things, which are just slightly different, have implications for how far we reach into different organisations and provide an integrated, citizen-centric view of the services we offer. Those have implications for our interest in IPv6. There are a couple of other drivers that are heading us towards this direction. One is, quite on the supply side, the economy. In case anyone hasn't noticed, in Wellington there's less money around than there used to be, which means we're having to look at our operating models and how and whether we can resource each other's, by each other's I mean other agencies, resources and capabilities and information and data to avoid duplication of effort and investment. That means we have to easily access those capabilities and resources within other organisations, which again is enabled somewhat by IPv6. Then looking at the demand side, we know from surveys we've done with the public and citizens and private businesses and so forth that people want more citizen-centric services or user-centric services. At the moment, I'm told that if you want to start a restaurant, you need to contact 17 different government organisations to get that restaurant up and running, which is obviously a pretty crazy way to do business with government. So if we're able to create a service for prospective restaurant owners where they can go in to one site, do all those transactions, and government sorts themselves out in the background according to what each agency wants, then that's a great thing, and we would have increased productivity. To enable that to happen, once again, requires some interaction between agencies and the end citizens to be able to reach deeply into those organisations and work with the information and data that's embedded right across government. There are a bunch of wider activities as well that will help enable adoption. I don't see, and I'm not aware of any specific mandates, unlike the our Australian counterparts. However, there are some enablers that we can see coming down the path that will help improve or could be used as a path to adoption. One is around standards. Standards development has been in government for quite a while. We've been focused on standards development for some time. The issue has been really that it stopped at development, some nice folders and documents have been created without talking about promulgation of those standards and adoption of those standards. So that's where we're going to start focusing a lot more. There's plenty of international standards that we can just adopt off the board and really focus on that promulgation aspect. Another enabler, if you like, has been the recent creation of what's called Common ICT Capability Governance Framework, which I know sounds pretty exciting, but is in actual fact a consistent way of dealing with shared services across government. Until this has come into play, each shared services has its own governance structure that's evolved along with the service that it's governing. The problem with that is there's no portfolio approach. There's no voice for the common investment requirements of the public sector to feed into and enable development of those services. So with this common framework, those shared services will reflect the common needs of the public service and the wider state sector, in fact. Another enabler is the procurement reform, which has been announced in the last couple of months, which is essentially government going out as a whole, or public sector, state sector going out as a whole and procuring things, aggregating demand. For that to happen, for both industry and ourselves to benefit from those potential efficiencies, one of the things that's required is standardisation, obviously. And standardisation is something that will now allow things like IPv6 to be promulgated throughout the public sector and state sector. Another aspect or driver to this is drive towards open data. In recent weeks, there's been a little bit of discussion around open data and opening up government data sets to private citizens and to private businesses to allow them to add value, interpret, challenge, and so forth, the public sector and government as a whole around how they're performing and so forth. That has quite good implications for the so-called e-democracy, making us ourselves much more transparent and visible. Again, to enable that kind of thing to happen, to allow citizens to reach deeply into organisations, pull out those data sets, again, needs the type of peer-to-peer relationships that IPv6 enables. The final thing, which reflects back to that e-government vision that I talked about before, is the online channel and the untapped potential of the use of the online channel to deliver frontline services. Back to my restaurant example, it's a lot easier to create an online presence that integrates all the agency needs on the internet than it is to create that in real life in bricks and mortar. And so we've been working with a number of agencies about development of their online channel strategy, and leveraging the online channel to help deliver frontline services. It's fair to say it's pretty early days. There's a long way to go in terms of how far we can take that, but certainly it reinforces that vision that I mentioned earlier. Now, specifically onto IPv6 and what we've done and what we're doing in that space. There's a thing called EGIF, which is a standards framework. We couldn't call it a standards framework because you couldn't make an acronym out of that. So we call it EGIF instead, which stands for Electronic Government Interoperability Framework. But under that, if you look under the covers, and not many people have, going back to my comments around development versus deployment of standards, IPv6 is actually recommended. The standard is recommended within that framework. Which means we should be using that in preference to IPv4 where we can. So there is actually a policy basis for uptake of IPv6 at the moment. Just no one knows about it yet. So we're working on that. On a much more practical note, most of you would have seen in the press fairly recently the announcement of the one.gov services that were awarded to Datacraft. And part of our evaluation was future capability, which and part of that was IPv6. And we were pleased to see that the OneGov set of services, they're IPv6 capable at the moment. The ISP function of that runs IPv6 natively. So we certainly see that as a potential platform for agencies to deploy IPv6 pretty easily. What else we're doing? We looked around government and have seen there's not a lot of practical implementation experience within government. So we're taking the approach of using Department of Internal Affairs ourselves and starting to do the policy development, strategy and architecture development, as well as a phase one implementation, which is really looking at our infrastructure basis. We've got a network refresh coming in June next year. We see that as a natural point to start looking at a dual stack implementation. And we've got a number of other infrastructure related aspects of that that we need to look at. One of those is our DNS capability. We moderate the .gov.nz domain, so we'll be looking at that as well and what we can do to make that IPv6 capable. So some of the messages that we see for government in terms of why we want to do this now, there's certainly a longer term game which I've been talking about in terms of the e-government strategy, but in the short term we certainly see the adoption of IPv6 now rather than later is a risk and cost avoidance exercise. So by building IPv6 into natural refresh cycles over the next few years, it's going to avoid a whole lot of pain in a few years' time when it has to be done. So we certainly encourage a little bit of policy development right now, and just implementation as the refresh cycles roll through over the next few years. In the medium term, we see the business case being focused on exploitation of the IPv6 protocol and some of the inherent benefits that brings in terms of security, remote access, and reduction of some of the complexity that we currently face at the moment. And there's certainly some good business case benefits there. In the long term, it really harks back to the e-government vision in terms of enabling citizen-centric services. And by enabling peer-to-peer connectivity from the citizen's device through to deep into the organisation where the data sits and so forth, it really enables that e-government vision that was proclaimed at the beginning. That's pretty much the end of my speech. Are there any questions?
Yeah. If I remember exactly, you said the phrase "prefer IPv6" as a matter of policy. And I'm thinking here, reachability in the DC space is going to be a really important part of deciding what policy makes sense. I think it's good. So if you were to exclusively prefer IPv6 and you don't have global connectivity for IPv6, you might be stepping into the policy that causes fragmentation.
So the exact word I used was recommended, and the definition under that standards framework.
The word you used was prefer, but anyway, I'll fight it later. I carefully noted that because that's why I'm reacting.
So
anyway,
okay, so the definition is recommended.
The label
is recommended. And the definition of that term within the standards framework is use the standard in preference where you are able to, okay, and otherwise use IPv4. So it certainly comes down to interpretation by the agencies in terms of where it makes sense for them to do that. But like I said, there is at least a policy basis for IPv6 adoption. Oh, absolutely agree. Yeah, absolutely agree.
One other question?
Oh, yes, one other. Sorry, nobody else does. I'll take a shot. The other thing on this connectivity and reachability thing, I keep thinking that the internet exchange points are likely places where one could encourage IPv6 and IPv4 interconnections. The bulk of the big traffic interconnections in the internet are peer-to-peer direct connections between parties as opposed to going to the internet exchange space, at least in the US. What's the situation in Australia with regard to internet exchange points? Do the largest ISPs directly connect with each other, or do they all still go through the exchange point?
I don't know, maybe
Andy?
Yeah.
I'm not so sure about the two ones. I can talk about what goes on here with the exchange points here, because there are some here.
I'm looking for either one.
Okay.
Both, actually. If you have information, take the one you have information for.
Okay.
Say
well,
the answer.
The two major exchange points in New Zealand are in Auckland and Wellington.
Okay. No surprises there.
No surprises. And there are smaller ones in some of the other regions.
Okay.
The Auckland and Wellington ones are... assessment from people who do a sort of multilateral peering thing, so you join the clubs part of the exchange. The two major tier ones in New Zealand, which are Telecom and Telstra, peer with each other, and in some places partly use that fabric to do that, but they don't peer with the tier twos, who are the smaller ISPs and so on. And again, probably no surprises, because that's the sort of nature of the ecosystem. If you look at the hierarchy of the tree as well, the tier ones do. So we have that sort of thing going on. And then we have some other interesting things that go on with people host websites overseas because transit's cheaper and they pull it back to New Zealand for all those sort of stupid things. So that's, and there is those multilateral peering points have both V4 and V6 implementation. And the number of V6 peers on Earth is still very small, and I don't believe represents anything, any sort of serious traffic at all. But there is some infrastructure there.
Could I follow up with one detail? Would it be at all helpful? I'm assuming something was making wrong, so you can keep up that, but would it be at all helpful if there was some, we use the word subsidy here, but some interconnection of the ISPs, as I can imagine a situation where smaller internet service providers might choose to peer locally with each other. The cost of doing that is the connections into the internet exchange point, but they might not connect to both internet exchange points. If the internet exchange points were connected, then anybody peering with someone at the one internet exchange point might implicitly be able to peer with people who terminate only at the other one. If that's at all helpful, I can imagine a government position which says we will assist in assuring that there is connectivity.
You're
part of
the U.S. government.
are we talking V6 for me?
Well, specifically, I'm looking for things that would facilitate increased V6 connectivity.
Okay. The two V6 exchange point, I'm actually just sitting in a jabber session with one of the guys at CityLink who runs the two, and he's talking about the link between the two is so poorly utilised that he's coming, which is done at the expense of the
various
things. So that's 5 minutes ago, you just chatted with me.
Perhaps you might be able to move that, like, substance.
No, that may change in just the future. You know, that may be if we get a lot of traction from this, people say, oh, it'd be fantastic if we had this. Then having something there that encouraged that might be a good thing.
So just to clarify, if this Charlie can do two great changes, they don't have more fans up here, so.
Because that trip is relatively small.
But as a catalyst, to do something that may be useful because it says, if this is subsidised until it gets, until 10 meg circuit is choked, once you've got to that point, then there's clearly a demand, and therefore.
And at that point, then the usual business deals cut in, and yes, I will or I won't hear depending on what. But the early stages, you want as much connectivity as you can get, so you don't have these peculiar fragmentations when you're trying to use.
And one of the reasons we're doing the V6 arrangements was so that people who have built tunnels to service providers in the States,
yes,
which it makes it even worse. So
the
round trips are bad, cost time are really bad. So a local exchange point to help with that situation with dealing with.
Part of that is an online identity verification service. So passport quality quality assurance online of who you are is essentially the goal of that. And tied into that is a very basic log-on service that we've created as well. But the log-on service uses things like SAML messaging and so forth. And the idea is it won't always be a log-on service. It might be using Cardspace or any of those open systems to do that authentication component. So there's no reason why it should actually be a government-issued card that does it. It could be a Snapper card.